I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the story of a serial killer who kidnapped and murdered for more than a decade before being caught in 2012. A man who would drive hundreds of miles to carry out his crimes, often snatching victims in broad daylight and disposing of their bodies quickly and efficiently. A man you've probably never heard of. Maureen Callahan's new book chronicles the life and crimes of Israel Keyes. We'll talk to her about the man who robbed and killed random people for years while simultaneously maintaining a quiet life as a contractor and devoted father back at his home base in Alaska. Our conversation starts after a short break. Aficionado to know who Ted Bundy is or John Wayne Gacy. Notorious serial killers often inspire documentaries, ripped from the headlines movies, and pop culture references. But drop the name Israel Keyes, and most people probably won't flinch. Maureen Callahan's new book makes it clear that we should. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. For more than a decade, Israel Keyes robbed, raped, kidnapped, and killed across the United States. He was highly skilled and able to escape detection in many states for years. When he was finally caught, he started to talk, unspooling his story, a harrowing portrait of a relentless killer. Investigative journalist Maureen Callahan tells the story in her new book, American Predator, The Hunt for the Most Meticulous Serial Killer of the 21st Century, and she joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. Maureen, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Courtney.
So when did you decide you wanted to get to know the case of Israel Keyes, and what made you want to write about it?
The moment I came across this story, I was, I don't even know if captivated is a strong enough word, I think, pretty much immediately obsessed. I got to the second paragraph of this story, and there were three facts contained within that just set me on fire. One was the apprehension of a serial killer, the likes of which the FBI had never seen before. The second was his modus operandi, which you touched on in your intro. And when I sort of detail it, it is astonishing. It is both crude and sophisticated, and allowed him to elude any sort of detection by law enforcement throughout the nation for well over 14 years. And the third was that the federal government had been keeping his existence a secret for the 9 months that they had had him in custody thus far. And taken together, I thought, there are going to be multiple mysteries here to unravel, and I was right about that, but I was unprepared for what I would ultimately encounter throughout the 5 years it took to do this book.
And we'll get deeper into this later in the show, but why were they keeping his apprehension and his story so secret? Was it because he wanted them to, or was it because they were embarrassed, or was it a combination?
Well, initially, the FBI's line was, you know, he demanded that his name be kept out of the national media because he had a young daughter and he didn't want her to grow up Googling him and learning all of these gruesome, grisly details of her father's secret double life. And there was truth to that. But as I began digging further and, you know, I began with the full cooperation of the FBI, and they gave me this unprecedented degree of access to the special agents who worked this case. And at a certain point, I think that they realized that they had maybe told me a little too much and sort of backed off. And that's when I really had to begin digging in and suing the Department of Justice and suing the federal prosecutor's office and learned that, you know, there were many, many mistakes made along the way here that compromised one of the most consequential investigations in modern American history.
So the book starts in Alaska, and it's effectively chilling because it's Alaska, but also what happens. And it essentially maps out the crime that led to Israel Keyes' arrest. What happened to Samantha Koenig?
Samantha Koenig was an 18-year-old barista who was working in one of the many coffee shacks that dot the highways and boulevards in Anchorage. These are really little shacks. They were typically staffed by teenage girls alone. In the summers, these girls would be made to wear bikinis often. And until Samantha's disappearance, it had never occurred to anyone in the community that this was putting young girls in a very vulnerable position. She vanished early on a Wednesday night from her kiosk when she should have been closing it up. Initially, law enforcement thought, this is a young girl who maybe has a bit of a troubled past. She robbed the till. She took off. We've got some angry text messages from her cell phone to her boyfriend. But the community at large, and Samantha's father in particular, are immediately alarmed, and they know something just isn't right. And in fact, the community was well ahead of law enforcement in this regard. It took, if you want to talk about mistakes made from the beginning, it took the Anchorage Police Department almost 24 hours to get a look at the surveillance video from inside the kiosk. And you see a large, tall, athletic man who is her last customer of the night, after a few minutes of standing outside and making small talk, leap into the kiosk like a cheetah. And even then, the investigators aren't sure if Samantha was abducted or not, because he was in there for 17 minutes. Or they were talking for 17 minutes, really. He was in there for about 10 to 12. There was a theory that she was in on it. This man was her accomplice. And then it's not until weeks later when a ransom note comes in with an ostensible proof of life photo of Samantha. Her hair is braided. Her face is made up. She's looking directly at the camera. And there's one investigator on the team, a very seasoned guy named Jeff Bell, who takes one look at that photo and says she is not alive.
So how did investigators finally start to make some progress on a suspect and get past the, she was troubled and ran off, or dad and boyfriend are involved? How did they finally decide to really just move forward and get some traction?
Well, the ransom note was the biggest break they had had in a case that had very quickly gone cold. And had that ransom note not come in, Samantha's case would have remained cold. Mm-hmm. Her father deposits about $30,000 into Samantha's account, and the FBI has a tracker now on her ATM card, and that ATM card begins pinging. And the ATM card begins pinging in the lower 48 in Arizona and New Mexico. And that's when law enforcement up in Anchorage in the dead of night and down in the Southwest light up, and this investigation begins to move like almost something out of a Hollywood movie. And they are chasing an unknown suspect. The best description they have of him is tall, probably middle-aged, most likely white, driving the most commonly rented vehicle in the United States of America. And by the time this card begins pinging in Texas, this be on the lookout, a bolo, comes into the inbox of a Texas Ranger named Steve Rayburn, and he takes one look at that most vague of descriptions and takes it upon himself to find that guy, and he does.
So Israel Keyes is pulled over, and it's what, near Lufkin, Texas, is that correct? Like Wells, that area?
Exactly. He's pulled over in Lufkin, Texas, going 2 miles over the speed limit.
They just had to wait for something to get him?
Anything. And he's getting closer to hitting the highway where he'll be able to just tear off. And in that moment, Steve Rayburn is on his radio saying to the corporal who's tailing Keyes, find a reason, find a reason. I don't care what you have to do, find a reason. And when Henry turns on his lights, He's not expecting this guy to pull over. He's not really doing anything wrong. And he watches in amazement as this car pulls into the Cotton Patch Cafe. And Henry walks up to the car and he says to the man, "Where are you from?" And when the man says Alaska, the way Henry described it, he almost had a heart attack.
That must have been incredible. And so do they have enough? They've pulled him over. He pulls over cooperatively. Do they have enough to make it stick and bring him back to Alaska, which is the hope?
So this is another high tension point in the investigation. Now on the scene is an FBI field agent named Deb Ganaway, and she's eyeballing this rental car. And inside she's seeing maps on the passenger seat with a lot of highlighted routes. She's seeing rolled up cash in the pocket of the doors that have exploded ink all over the paper. I mean, it's clearly cash from a bank robbery and the dye packs have exploded. She's getting a very bad vibe off of this guy. And so she calls the lead case agent up in Anchorage named Steve Payne. And Payne is agonizing over what to do. Because if they search that vehicle without probable cause, anything they turn up would be determined fruit of the poison tree and would probably not be admissible. So this guy would walk. And Ganaway explains to him, you know, she says, "I don't want to blow this for you. You should know in Texas we have an exemption here. If we think we have enough reason to search this car, we can do it. What do you want me to do?" And Payne is sitting there and thinking, and finally he says, "I don't want you to cut this guy loose without searching that vehicle." He says, "It doesn't matter to me how you do it," which was very unlike Payne, who is a really methodical, thoughtful, logical guy who now this late into the investigation is surprised himself to be driven by quite a lot of emotion over finding this missing girl. So they searched the vehicle, and among many other things, including disturbing levels of transgender pornography and, you know, a ski mask and headlamps. And they also turn up Samantha's cell phone, which has been broken apart and the battery has been ripped out. And once they take him into custody, they're finally able to search his wallet. And inside they find her ATM card.
So when did it become really clear to investigators that they had someone here who is really good at what he has been doing?
Almost immediately. Upon his arrest, Jeff Bell, who was working both with the Anchorage Police Department and the FBI, and Detective Monique Dahl, who was with APD, this was her very first homicide investigation, flew down to Texas immediately and got in a room with Keyes. And Jeff Bell is a very, very seasoned investigator. He's seen just about everything. And he told me the moment that he walked into that room, he knew that Samantha did not have a good outcome. It sounds like a cliche, but he said, you know, "The hairs on the back of my neck stood up." And he knew that Keyes had done this before. His affect, his demeanor, it was as though these people were disturbing his day, and he was not happy about it. And they tried to get information out of him. He had a crazy story about how he came into possession of Samantha's ATM card and her cell phone. And it was a wild story. It was outlandish. It was, frankly, unbelievable. And the investigators said as much to him. But the fact of the matter was that if he decided to stick to that story, he was going to walk because they had nothing else connecting him to her disappearance, nothing.
My guest this hour is investigative journalist Maureen Callahan. Her book is called American Predator: The Hunt for the Most Meticulous Serial Killer of the 21st Century. We'll be back after a short break. Listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is journalist Maureen Callahan. Her book is American Predator, The Hunt for the Most Meticulous Serial Killer of the 21st Century. So right before the break, we spoke about how Israel Keyes, who's a suspect in the disappearance of an Alaska 18-year-old named Samantha Koenig, had just been nabbed in Texas. They'd found incriminating things in his rental car, but he was acting like it was just a normal day for him and they were in the way. They needed him to say something to make sure that this could stick and he could be brought back to Alaska. So what happened?
So they do extradite him to Alaska on a charge of fraud with access device. That's the best they've got so far. And they also do have the suspicion that given this affect that, you know, you just described, he has done this before. So they know that this is probably the most high stakes interrogation of their careers. Mm-hmm. So Steve Payne talked to me a lot about the way in which he and Jeff Bell war gamed out what they were going to do when they got in a room with Keyes. He talked a lot about his preferred technique with what he called a dearth of evidence, and said that a lot of agents in that situation prefer to go into an interrogation room with a lot of props. They go in with boxes and they go in with these folders that are stuffed with paper, right, and they, you know, plop it all down and say, here's everything we've got on you. And of course, you know, the boxes are empty and the paper is blank and, you know, and Payne actually much prefers a counterintuitive approach where he goes in with nearly nothing and will sit down and just very calmly say, you don't get to know everything we've got on you. And 99.9% of the time that works. And so Payne had chosen Bell to really lead this investigation because Bell was the one who tended to have the greatest rapport with the worst that humanity has to offer. And then as they're about to go in the 11th hour, this case takes yet another dramatic turn. They get a phone call from the federal prosecutor assigned to this case, Kevin Feldes, and he tells them, this is my investigation now. And what he's doing is beyond overreach. It's prosecutorial misconduct, but this is part of the insular nature of Anchorage and the way in which things are done that is anathema to most of the rest of the country. And so, you know, once they capture the bad guy, another villain emerges, but this villain is on the side of the good guys. So the case just gets wilder and wilder.
So you have someone from the U.S. Attorney's Office who's kind of forced his way into the room, and now you have kind of different approaches. How do they kind of crack him open? How do they get Israel Keyes to start talking?
Well, it was two-pronged. Feldes went in and led that initial interrogation, and that is also something that the government has kept hidden for the past 5 or 6 years, that initial confession to Samantha and what happened that night and how Keyes did it and what happened to Samantha and where she was. And I eventually obtained it through a source who wishes to remain anonymous, but it has never been logged as existing anywhere. And part of it, I think, is because when you go through that first interrogation, and it's in the book, you see the ways in which Kevin Feldes, who had never sat across from a violent criminal before, let alone one of this magnitude, he had done white collar, that was it, nearly blew it several times, and showed how little the FBI had on him, let alone how much they knew about him. You can tell how fearful Feldes begins to read in that room. And, you know, keep in mind, you're sitting across from a predator who smells fear instantaneously. Towards the end of that first interrogation, Keyes has given them really nothing other than to say, yes, he's responsible for Samantha's death. But they need details and they need a full confession, because without that, having no evidence, Keyes could later turn around and say, I recant, or I had an accomplice and the accomplice did it. So they need those details. And Keyes says, I'll tell you everything you want to know, but I want to talk to, what's that detective's name? The one who came and saw me in Texas, Mickey? Mickey Dahl? Yeah, I want to talk to her. And so Dahl comes in the next day and plays it very differently than Keyes, than Feldis had with Keyes. And what follows is sort of this dynamic that I liken to a sort of Hannibal Lecter, Clarice Starling dynamic. You know, Keyes clearly saw himself, you know, it sounds horrible to say, but in terms of monsters, he saw himself as a great. He would have seen himself in the Pantheon. They knew from searching his house that he had a voluminous collection of books and films about serial killers, both fictional and real. And Monique Dahl was a very glamorous, charismatic homicide detective. And she had the movie star quality that he would have found himself worthy of. And what follows in that interrogation is a master class in how to leverage a full confession out of nothing.
And that's what we get as readers, because of all the investigation you've done, we get to find out what happened to Samantha. So can you kind of enlighten us what actually happened that night that she was taken?
You know, it's remarkable when I read it. What Keyes says happened runs counter to the official version of events later issued by APD and the FBI. Keyes had Samantha with him for hours that night, and they had been seen at least 13 times out in public. There were chances, and she had tried to run away from him at one point, and he got her and said, you know, if you do that again, I'll kill you. And that was enough to terrify her. But that nobody had called her in as missing throughout the night. You know, there was a moment when around 3 a.m., her boyfriend who lived with Samantha and her father, you know, she hadn't been home yet, and they were both sitting up and they were concerned. And for some reason, the boyfriend feels the need to go open the door and look out up and down the street. And he does so, and he sees a strange man in the cab of the truck he shares with Samantha going through the passenger side, going through the glove box. And the man locks eyes with him, and they both freeze for a moment. And the man runs down the street, and the boyfriend closes the door and goes back in the house and doesn't call the cops. And this for a while led the investigators to think that the boyfriend had something to do with it, or that her father had something to do with it. And so Keyes is relaying the story that they're finding, frankly, incredible. And he finally brings Samantha home. He's got several sheds on his very small property, and he puts her in one of those sheds. He waits for his girlfriend to go to sleep. His daughter is asleep. She's 10. He goes back out into that shed. He rapes Samantha. He strangles her. And then he says he leaves about an hour later, the next morning, with his daughter for a cruise, a 10-day cruise. And it's at this point in the interrogation where you can see the danger of having someone like Feldis in the room, because Feldis says to him, well, was she alive when you left? And Keyes says to him, well, that would seem an obvious question. And Feldis says, well, so she was alive. And Keyes says, what? And Feldis says, she was alive. And he says, no. And in that moment, Steve Payne and Jeff Bell know this is out of control. This is a desperate situation. They've got a guy who somehow disposed of a body in his shed where it had been sitting for well over a month while APD and the FBI are running all over Anchorage searching for her. She's literally in their backyard. And this guy is, he's got more stories to tell, as he told them.
And that moment, knowing that he'd committed this crime in this incredibly narrow window of time in his own backyard, was that another tell that, I mean, he obviously believed himself capable of quite a bit?
Oh, definitely. I mean, at this point, the FBI still does not believe that he's not working without an accomplice, that there's no way one individual holds this young girl hostage for about 6 hours, traipsing her all throughout Anchorage. People are out. You know, he took her a little after 8 p.m., then drives her to, you know, he lived on a very heavily populated street in a suburb that is teeming with judges and lawyers, and then holds the remains in his own shed in his backyard for weeks on end. They're in disbelief. But what he says to them is, I'm going to tell you something right now. There is nobody who has known me or who has ever known me who knows anything about me. I am two different people, basically. And someone in that room offhandedly says to him, how long have you been two different people? And he takes a beat and he chuckles and he says, a long time, 14 years. And in that moment, they know they've got to go back 14 years at least, is as long as this guy has been active.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. What was so riveting to me about reading this portrait of a relentless killer was he really does manage all of this simultaneously while parenting and running his contracting business. I think you'd chronicle when he disposes of her body that he's kind of doing it in stages because he's got to take care of like dinner and homework for his daughter. I mean, it's just unbelievable that he had these two things going on at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, even the agents were shocked by that. I mean, it's interesting because when they first captured him and were listening to the Samantha confession unfolding, you know, these agents immediately went to Quantico and went to the top criminal profilers who were listening in and said, please help us. You know, we tell us what to do in order to get more confessions out of him. And the only thing that these expert profilers could tell them was that Israel Keyes was one of the most terrifying subjects that even they had ever encountered, and that they had never seen one like him. And the only advice they could give was to keep him talking. They said the smarter ones love to talk. And he was one of the smarter ones. And yeah, he disposed of Samantha's remains in over three trips during the day, never concerned about ever being pulled over for a traffic stop. He went out to Matanuska Lake and pitched an ice fishing tent, very common, and over the course of 3 days disposed of her remains at the bottom of that lake. They were weighted down. One of those trips conflicted with a parent-teacher conference that had been scheduled for his 10-year-old daughter, who he was enrolling in a gifted and talented program. By all accounts, he was an extremely devoted father. And the people for whom he did contracting work, almost all of them said they trusted him implicitly. They would leave him with the keys to their homes while they were traveling so that he could come and go and do his work at will. And they never found anything out of place. They never found anything missing, never a thing awry.
So he gave investigators the location of the remains at some point, which kind of enabled them to close this case. And there's such a sad, kind of touching scene in the book where you talk about how there was signs up at the local stores that, you know, kind of hopeful signs that Samantha would be returned. And by the end of the divers retrieving remains from the bottom of that lake, the sign had already changed to a sign of grief. Can you describe kind of how that all went?
Yeah, the Samantha disappearance really deeply traumatized Anchorage. She was special. You know, people, I talk about the psyche of Anchorage in the book and the psyche of Alaska because it is so specific and unique. Anchorage in particular is populated by a lot of expats from the lower 48. And these are people who are looking to get lost. And there is a fierce, rugged sense of individualism and pride there. And the people who go to get lost, some do it as sort of a form of slow suicide. And that's okay up there. That's your right. But when Samantha disappeared, you know, again, the community knew that this wasn't a girl who ran off, and this wasn't a girl who had overdosed and frozen to death in the snow. Often happens. They knew something was really, really, really wrong. And the tensions in the community between the residents and law enforcement were so high that the FBI agents in Anchorage had to beg the dive team to make an exception and come immediately to execute this recovery. Normally, it takes them months of prep. But they did. They got there immediately, and I talked to those guys, and they were left traumatized by what they saw.
My guest this hour is journalist Maureen Callahan. Her book is American Predator: The Hunt for the Most Meticulous Serial Killer of the 21st Century. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. We're speaking today with Maureen Callahan. She's a journalist, and her book is American Predator: The Hunt for the Most Meticulous Serial Killer of the 21st Century. So we've been speaking about Israel Keyes, who had confessed to murdering an 18-year-old Alaska girl named Samantha Koenig, but he had said something cryptic to investigators that he'd been two different people for about 14 years. And why did that stick with them, and what did that mean they now had to try to uncover?
That statement really set the launch pad for what I call in the book phase two of the investigation, which is, who is Israel Keyes? That part of the investigation really takes off after Keyes is pushing for the death penalty, and he wants it fast. And the FBI is leveraging that, and they're saying, well, if you want it, you've got to give us something else. So he says, okay, I'll give you two bodies. I'll give you two bodies and a name. And he then confesses to yet another cold case, this one on the other side of the country, a couple that the year before had gone missing from their bedroom in suburban Vermont in the dead of night, not a trace of them ever recovered. And again, what he's telling them is so incredible that they're having trouble believing it. You know, he's got these kill kits buried all over the country, he says. And these are these buckets from Home Depot that he's filled with guns and ammo and rope and zip ties and cash from bank robberies he's previously committed, and Drano, which he's learned accelerates human decomposition, and they're all over. And so what he likes to do is buy a one-way plane ticket into a major hub, rent a car. He's got his cell phone off, his battery out. He has gone dark, as he calls it. He's using only cash. He drives hundreds of thousands of miles, hundreds or thousands of miles, I should say. And he recovers one of these kill kits, and then he starts looking for victims. And again, what makes him so terrifying is that, unlike most serial killers who have a victim type, you mentioned Ted Bundy at the top of your show, and Bundy liked, you know, to go after young white women who had long straight hair parted down the middle, very specific. But Keyes had no victim type. He would go after young, old, black, white, Hispanic, skinny, overweight. They looked well off. They looked indigent. It didn't matter. He was a true apex predator. He would hunt for people in broad daylight. He would hunt for them in the dead of night in their own homes. He would abduct them, take them to another location, rape, torture, kill them, move the remains to yet another location, preferably across state lines, dispose of the remains so expertly that he's left no DNA behind. Then he gets in that car and he puts thousands of miles immediately between himself and that crime scene. So in essence, he says to the FBI, you think you're going to solve any others without me? I don't think so. And so now they've got to figure out who he is, who he was, and how he got this way.
I almost chuckled for maybe the only time reading this book when you listed some of his, quote, favorite states, and I counted, and you listed 27 of them. So obviously he just went wherever he felt like he could go. It wasn't like he had a little region or a pocket. If he visited often 27 different states, I mean, it must have just felt like an interminable landscape was stretching in front of investigators.
You know, it's so interesting, too, because I realized that later in the reporting for the book. You know, among the things I was pushing for were documents I didn't even know existed. The FBI, when this case, when they officially called it closed, but within the Bureau, the agents who worked this case told me this case will never be considered closed. You know, the FBI put up a timeline of Keyes's known travels online and begged the public for help in generating new leads. You know, and then they pretty quickly tore this case back from public view. But I obtained the FBI's secret internal timeline of Keyes's known travels, and this was far more detailed. And when you truly see the scope and scale of his travels, the ones that just the FBI knows about throughout this country, I mean, I say towards the end of the book, and it's not hyperbole, any one of us could have been a victim of Israel Keyes. And there are a number of cold cases in the book that I explore that law enforcement has reason to believe were committed by Israel Keyes and that I think should get another look.
How many people do investigators think Israel Keyes killed?
Okay, so the official line is 11. Keyes said less than 12. And the agents, most importantly, Steve Payne, who is a math guy and, you know, thought, okay, well, most people round by fives or tens. So if he's saying less than 12, we'll go with 11. I think it was far higher. There are other agents who worked this case who think it was far higher. There's a moment in one of the interrogations where someone says to Keyes, quite frankly, we have to assume that every time you've traveled, you've killed someone. And Keyes didn't answer. He just chuckled. And the way that that question was posed, you can hear this interrogation online. It was as much of a statement as anything. This was Israel Keyes' sole reason for living, was to hunt and kill human prey. And I also believe that his first murder was when he was probably 16 or 17, definitely longer than 14 years, predating him enlisting in the United States Army, which is a whole other mystery unto itself, how he even enlisted in the United States Army. He had an extremely unusual upbringing. And as he told the investigators, he never existed on paper. He was a home birth and homeschooled. He had no birth certificate, no social security number, no educational history, no medical history, no passport. And yet this guy somehow rolls into a recruitment office in New Jersey in 1998, and it joins the United States Army.
The detail I have to ask about, because this, it was nearly impossible for me to wrap my head around. I actually had to text both my producer and husband after reading it because I couldn't get over it, was the reason to believe that he got elective surgeries performed on him in Mexico. What may he have been doing, according to investigators?
Well, this is, again, contained in that secret timeline. And I've heard another theory that those elective procedures were actually undergone by his girlfriend. Hmm. Now, his girlfriend at the time was a very well-educated, well-compensated travel nurse. If she's getting elective surgery, it's happening in the United States. It's not happening in Tijuana at some, you know, shop with like a sign hanging out the, you know, window. Right. It's not. One of the surgeries that Keyes notated in his own calendar was gastric bypass. And he was always an extremely athletic, rangy, tall guy. He was described by members of his platoon, who were later interviewed by the FBI, as a super soldier. He could carry 150 pounds on his back and walk 13 miles and not break a sweat. The idea that he would need weight loss surgery of any kind, it just boggles the mind. And the only thing I could come up with was he's looking for ways to eliminate distractions, biological necessities while he's on the hunt, because he's going 24, 48 hours straight. And hunger and the need to urinate and defecate, that's right up there. And he was so diabolical and so, I hate to say it, but inventive, that I think it's highly likely that that was at least one intervention he had undergone.
And this is the man that's already burying preloaded, you know, body disposal kits across the country.
Yeah, and they're still out there, too. I mean, Jeff Bell's great hope is that someone somewhere uncovers a kit, because that means that hopefully they've got another geographic region to look at for a missing person who might have been fallen victim to Israel Keyes.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. You spoke a bit about his childhood. It was incredibly off the grid. Parents had a lot of mistrust of government. Were there those classic early signs that he was headed toward relentless killer in his childhood? Anything that could have been uncovered about that?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I spoke to his mother for this book, and it was interesting because she had never spoken to a journalist before, and she hasn't since. She readily admitted that her son was evil. She, however, downplayed any real knowledge of the manifestation of his psychopathy from a very young age, which really, it was the textbook progression of what would be a budding serial killer, from breaking and entering to arson fires to the torture and mutilation of household pets. What made Keyes even more of a cluster bomb was growing up in such extreme isolation, raised by parents with such a profound distrust and actual hatred of the federal government, an indoctrination into a white supremacist church called the ARC, where he befriends at a very young age two brothers named Chevy and Shane Kehoe. The Kehoes later grow up to become among the FBI's 10 most wanted, and upon their arrest, one of the brothers flips and implicates the other as a co-conspirator with Timothy McVeigh in the Oklahoma City bombing. And what makes the Keyes case larger than just, okay, yes, it's an unprecedented serial killer. There's a number of cold cases that likely could be solved. But at some point in this investigation, the FBI reclassifies it from serial murder, Israel Keyes, to terrorism.
Do we know why?
We do not. I uncovered that through my years of fighting for documents in this case, but the FBI never made that public. They never have. I would love for them to tell us why. I think the American public has a right to know what Israel Keyes had done or what he was planning to do.
He seems like such a precision killer from, you know, everything that people found out about him. But were there any slip-ups or victims he let go maybe earlier on in his killing career?
Yes. There is at least one for certain. A second, I believe, is extremely likely. The first was a young girl he confessed to raping in Maupin, Oregon. Would have been the mid to late 90s. and he let her go. He regretted that. I talked to Jeff Bell a lot about the likelihood of that victim ever coming forward. At the time, he felt the case was too low profile, and really hoped that she would. But he also pointed out that, you know, survivors of sexual assault, as violent and traumatic as that one was, sometimes they don't make it themselves. There's another case that I explore in the book. It's known as the Boca Killer. This was a tall, white, rangy man who wore a military hat, who was targeting women and young children at the parking lots of upscale malls in Boca Raton in broad daylight. He killed a mother and her young child, a second woman that he had taken on her own. There was a third survivor. She is known as Jane Doe. She and her toddler son escaped relatively unscathed. And she went to the police. When her kidnapper let her go, he tied her up with zip ties by the neck, which the FBI called as unique as a fingerprint, and that was Keyes's MO. The kidnapper said, "When the cops come, I want you to tell them I am short, fat, and black." And she worked up a sketch with a police artist, and that sketch is a dead ringer for Israel Keyes. And I hope that Jane Doe is still out there and goes to local law enforcement.
So we are nearly out of time, but just clue everyone in on how the story ended. He did not get his expedited death penalty that he requested.
He did not. You know, it's interesting. I've encountered a fair number of readers who have told me that they are actively avoiding looking up this case online to see how it ends. So I'm reluctant to spoil it.
Okay, that's fair.
But I will say, you know, how this case concludes opens up yet just another larger mystery.
My guest this hour is Maureen Callahan, journalist and author of American Predator, The Hunt for the Most Meticulous Serial Killer of the 21st Century. Maureen, thank you so much for your time. What an interesting conversation.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for having me, Courtney. Likewise.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks so much for listening and have a great day.